3 years after his death, a new book offers for the first time a comprehensive look at the life, work and legacy of painter Melvin Day, also known as Pat. Encompassing seven prolific decades of art into a book proved a challenge for the five writers, who discuss his paintings and contribution to New Zealand's art history as an artist, art historian and director of the National Gallery for a turbulent decade. He's well known for his early Cubist works, but tried many different styles over the years. You can see some of them on our webpage at rnz.co.nz/standingroomonly. Co-editor Greg O'Brien is also one of the essayists in the book, and I asked why he believes that Pat Days has been overlooked.
He's a very significant figure, but I guess in terms of painting, people don't quite know how to identify him. He doesn't have a signature style in a way, because as you'll see from looking at the book, he went through these amazingly dramatic transitions from painting Maori portraits to doing Cubism, doing abstract art, and then
still
doing
life,
quite classical still life painting. So in the end, he ended up in a very, in a way you could say traditionalist, although I would say it's very revisionist kind of place. But I think he's been a slightly elusive figure. He never exhibited a lot in Auckland, and that's something you probably need to do to be on the national stage. He was involved in the art world as the director of the National Art Gallery in Wellington from 1968 to 1978. So in a way, that sort of pushed him out of the discussion a bit, because he couldn't really exhibit so freely, although he did keep exhibiting to some extent during those years. But he was really meant to be an arts administrator, meant to be an objective presence in the art department rather than a subjective one. You know, he was meant to be looking after the country's art rather than pursuing his own ends and his own objectives. So it's quite a little labyrinth of a career, really. And as a personality, I guess he wasn't a great salesman or a showman. He was quite a quiet, genteel man, very, you know, gentle person, very opinionated, had very strong opinions and strong viewpoints, but was pretty inscrutable, you know, didn't broadcast them.
What have you learned about Melvin through this process, you and the other contributors, that maybe you didn't know when you went into it?
I think the thing probably, the little moment I had, I guess, of revelation when I was doing the book was trying to wonder, you know, later in life he did a lot of landscape paintings around Wellington Harbour, but a lot of them are kind of divisioned up and cut up with lines and almost mathematical divisions. And I was never quite sure where that came from, and he never would explain it away or anything. You could say it was a little bit of an afterglow of Cubism. But then when I was listening to an interview he did with Ron Brownson at the Auckland Art Gallery, I came upon this interesting fact that during the Second World War, you know, he was conscripted and ended up in the infantry, and then through a wonderful course of events, which I talk about in the book, he ended up stationed on Motutapu Island in the Hauraki Gulf for 2 months, and at other places around there for a longer period of time. And his job was really to look at the landscape and division it up in terms of certain kind of things they wanted to achieve, sight lines. They were putting lookouts on the mouth of, you know, Auckland Harbour. This was during the Japanese invasion scare. As well as looking at landscape, he was trying to find a way of measuring it, defining it, matching human thought with the landscape for practical ends at that point in time. But then later on, when he was living on the mouth of Wellington Harbour, because he lived for many years in Seatoun, quite near the wharf there, so basically his daily nourishment for his eyes was looking across the water towards Pinkaro and the other side of the harbour, he started painting it, but he started dividing it up into kind of almost mathematical divisions, like slicing it. It's almost a bit like, at times it can almost be like a piece of cake or a pitched tent, putting diagonal lines, vertical lines through it. And I never knew what he was doing there, but then actually when I heard that interview and started talking to people and started reading some of the things he'd written, that sort of made sense. That yes, what he was doing, he was going back to that very early, quite intense experience of landscape. And I think at the same time he was looking at Cézanne and he was reading about Western art. But he was given this job and he said he didn't have very much to do out there. And I think by the time he got to Motutapu, they weren't really that worried about the Japanese. But he was told to find landscapes where they could put gun emplacements or whatever, and sort of somehow draw them up in a plausible way. So you have this funny sort of, I suppose it's a mixture of kind of a pragmatic job he had to do. But also I think he got very interested in proportion, sight lines, perspective, optical science, and other things too. So that was a lovely little, I guess, link in the book, linking the early chapters, which I write mostly, with, you know, the very end of his life with this phase of landscape painting.
You describe him as somebody who was always learning. Learning was very important to him. And maybe that explains why there's such variety in the book. You might see the still lives and then that different period, just say, with the landscapes. And the portraits are very striking. I think particularly the Māori portraits of some of the soldiers, you know. And I wonder, would I know, if I didn't know they were all in one book, would I know it was by the same artist? But do you see something linking all those different works that he does and all that experimentation that he does over such a long time?
I suppose, I mean, I do see a strong link, but as you say, Lynn, I mean, it is the transitions that are almost the most fascinating thing, because I think he was very, I mean, in a way, he was probably a very sensitive temperament. He reacted to where he was and who he was with, and so, you know, in the 1930s, he studied at Elam with Lois White, people like that. He was doing kind of a little bit neo-romantic, quite traditional art, some of it.
You've got some of the works from the 30s, haven't you?
Yeah, there's some fantastic. He did a couple of great still lives while he's still in his teenage years, which are in the book. Goes to Rotorua after the war, so this is after this experience out there on Motutapu, and is thrown into a Māori community, and I think feels a great attachment and interest in them and enthusiasm for them in their lives. And that phase of his art is all about meeting the people in Rotorua. Then he discovers, he makes friends with various of the artists who are based there, W.S. Wallace principally, but also John Weeks. Then you have him, suddenly he's learning all about Cubism. He's all about Cubism. By the late 1950s, he's discovered Mark Tobey and American abstract art, and the paint's still flowing, his mark-making and his sort of... in a way, the temperament is through all these works, so they are very linked. But he's reacting to this knowledge that he's just attained about, you know, American art. Then he ends up going to the Courtauld, where he studied art history. And by the time he came back in the mid-60s from then, he was the most qualified art historian in New Zealand. So you can tell he's getting a lot of material into his mind. And I think he's struggling probably at that point to find time and the circumstance to actually get it out as painting. But he is studying and learning. And then through the 60s and the 70s, he was doing these art history-inspired paintings, which are full of references, you know, to Uccello and Della Francesca and the Renaissance.
Do you enjoy those works?
I think they're difficult works. They're interesting works. I mean, to me, they're not as kind of alluring as some of the other ones. I mean, I love his early Cubist works. I think they're sparky. They're inspired by Paul Klee and all sorts of European art. But also they seem to have a little bit of they have a strong relationship to New Zealand as a place. But I think you can see him looking at Māori rock art and getting into a more tactile sense of being in landscape and being in place.
And being in New Zealand landscape. Because as you say, so much of his inspiration, you can see it in so much of his work, clearly referencing the European tradition rather than the New Zealand tradition at the time. So when he gets into, the Māori rock art representation, that feels more like home.
It does, yeah. No, those inscription works, I think, I mean, they're from the late 50s and they've aged fantastically. They look as fresh as anything. I mean, you could say with the art history works that I mentioned before, they're the ones where he probably feels like he's gone furthest away from New Zealand. Interestingly, when he was in London, the paintings that he did, there's a great work called Vertiginous, which is in the Wellington City Council building. He painted Northland in New Zealand when he was in London, you know, like a lot of people, like his contemporaries, you know, like John Drawbridge and Don Peebles. You know, he sort of washed up in London in the winter and just painted blue paintings of the Pacific to probably try and remain sane and you know, positive about things. But then I suppose he had the period as the director of the gallery, and then from the 80s onwards, I guess that's when he was sort of living in Seatoun, painting, selling quite a lot of work. He did a lot of, you know, small still lives, which are, I think, they're very cool, and there was a market for them, so he was able to support himself painting. But he loved still life and he loved landscape, because, I mean, they are two of the cornerstones of, you know, the Western painting tradition in recent centuries anyway. And he did some portraiture on the side as well. So, I think it is a strong story of place, but I suppose it's a story about New Zealand and going away and coming back, you know. But it's also, I guess, it's very much a chart of his intellectual preoccupations, and, you know, and he ranged widely. He had good friends, John Golding, and, you know, some very important art historians in England. He was taught by Anthony Blunt, who's on the latest season of The Crown, you know, on TV.
The
famous royal art historian who was a spy for the KGB, you know. So Anthony Blunt was his lecturer at the Courtauld. So he sort of felt quite at home with that crowd. And interestingly, because I know a lot of New Zealanders didn't, you know, but various people I know that have been to the Courtauld say it's quite very English, you know. Whereas actually I think Pat Day was probably maybe he was quite a slight man, a bit of a wisp. He seemed to be able to go in there, and after studying there, he actually taught there for a time. So he was actually probably more assimilated into that English model of the art historian than anyone else, you know. And then he came back from there to take up the position of the National Art Gallery in Wellington as the director. So that was the circumstance that brought him back to New Zealand. You know, so he's a sort of a little bit of an enigma, and that's good. That's what makes the work interesting, what makes the book interesting, I think. I mean, what the choices that he made. He made a choice later on to go back to, you know, oil painting in a way that was very unfashionable, you know, doing these still life paintings.
I hadn't realised, I know the story had been told before, that he was just 11 when he started going to Elam.
Yeah, you know,
how could that possibly happen? I mean, it's wonderful, but you can't imagine it happening now, but how did it happen then?
I suppose he was a prodigious boy, I guess. I mean, and Elam went at the time he went to there, it wasn't structured like a full-time art school, so I guess there were people on evenings and weekends and all that. But there is a drawing that he did when he was at, I think they were living somewhere near Papakura or somewhere at the time. There's a beautiful drawing that he produced in the book, I think he did when he was 13 or 14. And it's fantastic. I mean, he's a fantastic draftsman. I think he's one of those kids who can draw, you know. I think they still exist. I hope they still exist out there. But I remember when I was young, there'd be, you know, kids that could really draw realistic things, you know. He had that facility. And certainly when he was at Elam as a boy, he did quite traditional things. He did a lot of still lives. And again, that's interesting because late in life, he came back to the still life again and the whole the problems of, you know, chiaroscuro and shadow and three-dimensional form and tone and all those sort of, you know, kind of old-school technical kind of challenges of painting, really. And they're very enigmatic. And I guess, like, I love painters that are enigmatic. It's nice to be left with something to wonder over for a few decades or generations or something.
Is there a painting that... I've asked this before, saying, you know, you'd love to be able to hang in your drawing room, but is there a painting that you are particularly drawn to, Greg, you found yourself thinking more about or writing more about or wondering more about of his?
Probably the painting actually I have thought about the most is that one I mentioned before called Vertiginous, the one that the Wellington City Council bought. I was sort of involved in the process when they bought the painting, so it was when Melvin, who was known as Pat generally in his life, when Pat Day was still alive, and after we did an exhibition at the City Gallery, which I curated in 2005, the council had the good sense to approach him about buying a major work. So they we were able to go through the available works, and the work called Vertiginous, which I think is a total cracker of a painting. I'm just trying to find it in the book now, flicking my way through here. So that's just one I feel a really strong connection to. It's based on, in a way, Northland, Vertiginous. It's about vertigo, about being dizzy, being unbalanced.
Very strong colours, hey, those reds just...
Yeah, and it's really thick, heavy paint. He did these things. For someone that could be very graceful with paint, he did some paintings which are really ugly. Like, they're really, you know, globs of paint. You know, he'd use palette knives and, you know, his hands, and they're very raw, very physical. That interests me about him. He's a bit of a paradox. He knew all the rules, and later in life did these classical still lives, you know. But boy, at other times he could be, you know, a real crazy man in the studio. And I think I like that painting. It holds together beautifully, really solid. But actually, when you go near it, it's sort of kind of a bit scary and a bit unusual and a bit inconceivable. It's one of those paintings you look at and think, it shouldn't really work. Why the hell does it work, you know? People like me that have worked as art historians are always told to explain why things work. I just love these works that you can encounter from time to time, and you look at them and you think, oh, God, that shouldn't work, but it's magnificent. And that's almost the best paintings. I think McCann could do that a bit, you know. Am I scared, boy, eh? You sort of think, nah, that's just like a little kind of throwaway thing. But it's powerful. You know, how did that happen? Not quite sure.
You knew Pat, you knew Melvin. Do you think that, I know this is a tricky question, but this has been done, you know, after his death, 3 years after his death, this has come out. Do you think this would mean something to him, as an art historian himself, that his work has been gathered together, reflected on, recognised in this way? I mean, did he die feeling good about himself and his career, do you think?
I didn't see a lot of him at the very end of his life, Lynn, but no, I know that Tony Mackle, who wrote an essay for the book, he worked with, he and Melvin worked together in the National Art Gallery in the 70s, and they're very, you know, kept a critical distance. He wasn't chummy with everybody, but he admired Tony and his scholarship. Julia Waite at the Auckland Art Gallery he thought was fantastic because she curated a Cubism show about 3 or 4 years ago, which featured Melvin Day's work in it. And she did a great catalogue. And so she's written a fantastic chapter about Pat's Cubist work for the book. Vincent O'Sullivan, the writer, of course, Melvin admired Vincent very much. And he's done a great job in writing about the English years. And Mark Hutchins, of course, Mark Hutchins Pond, who's written a couple of chapters and also co-edited the book with me. Mark was his dealer for some years. Mark is on the trust that look after his legacy, I guess. So I think it fell in good hands. And I mean, I was very pleased to be able to come along and be involved. You know, as I say, I've curated an exhibition of Pat's. I'd spent a bit of time in his studio. I knew how he went about what he did. I've always been fascinated with that generation. I mean, I've written about Ralph Hawtrey and John Drawbridge in particular, but also people like Peebles and Ted Balmore and going back a little bit, Rita Angus. So they're a kind of a group of artists that I've always been fascinated by. And so so I could jump in. So I think, you know, from wherever he is up on his cloud, I think he'd be looking down thinking that this is pretty good. However, he would quarrel with all sorts of things. He would say we put in too many of the early Cubist paintings because he was a little bit beyond them later in life, you know, so I think he thought too much was being made of them. So I think we've carried on in that tradition of making too much of them because they're fantastic, but they're also a great invigorating dose of a regional cubism, of, you know, experimental art happening in Rotorua and down the road from Rotorua. And I love that. I love that great paradox. People expect modernism to happen in Paris and New York, but the idea that it's happening in Hamilton and Matamata and Rotorua, I think that's really good. Because of the mind he had, he would have sort of not quarrelled. He would have questioned the exact choice of works and probably argued other ones to go in the book. You know, but I think in the way, you know, given that everyone that worked on the project knew him, and also Brett Corum, the designer, did a fantastic job and was given some good resources and has done it on great paper. And you know, was it the gold leaf around the edges? So that the insects can't eat it, which is why they used to do that back in the Renaissance. See, this detail would not have been lost on Melvin Day, being a Renaissance man. But, you know, the reason you put gold leaf around the edges is to stop bugs from eating the paper. So we've got that. So I think that's a lovely little... He would have liked that, and he would have probably thought that was like a nice little joke, as well as being a practical thing.
Gregory O'Brien, one of the authors who produced Melvin Day Artist. It's published by Victoria University Press and Waikato Museum.